Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science, the only podcast about political economy and anime. I am Ryan Salisbury.
And I'm Peter DeBeer. I feel like I need to work on that because it feels like I'm about to say more, but I'm not. I'm definitely...
You just need to change the lilt at the end.
And I'm Peter DeBeer.
Yeah.
I'm Peter DeBeer. I'll practice that this whole week.
Just okay, like everyone you walk by in public, just be like, I'm Peter DeBeer. They'd be like, okay. All right, bud.
The funny thing is, there's so many expat workers here from Southeast Asia and from India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. Like, I'd probably walk up to them, and then they'll start in on lengthy conversations with me. And this can get problematic when you're standing around in 45 degree Celsius heat.
Yeah. So, it's 45 degrees over there, which is not very hot at all, as we Americans know. It's actually pretty cold.
Yeah. And I'm putting on extra layers as we speak.
Yeah.
And by extra layers, I mean extra layers of fucking sunscreen. I wear sunscreen indoors. Okay, so today's episode is a little bit of an interesting one. It was an idea that I popped up to Ryan a while ago, especially with everything going on in geopolitics at the moment. And we're going to be talking about sanctions.
Yeah, we finally stopped being lazy about it, and we got it done.
Yeah.
And we're also going to get it done right now by doing this thing here that we're talking to you
about.
It's
gonna be great. So everyone settle down, put your earphones on.
An expert at derailing.
I think we're both experts. Yeah. I'm more subtle about it because I don't talk about the fact
we should
that
both
I'm
be good. Saboteurs, dude.
Like, and just
we should
get
paid by some
to
union
podcasts
to like sabotage businesses.
Oh God, that would be amazing.
Yeah, like there, right, you guys don't understand. We can turn any meeting discussion into literally any subject with like two moves.
Just pick your subject, man. Pick your subject.
Yeah.
My mother actually holds a record in a speech and drama contest back in South Africa for the most number of topics covered in a 30-minute speech, and I think she covered something like 78 topics.
Damn.
And all of them are interconnected, obviously. There's no, let me completely change the subject now. There's like just a flowing 30-minute speech of just changing topics like twice a minute.
I feel like between all my time spent on Twitter and Wikipedia, I would be pretty good at that.
Yeah. I can keep going for ages. We had a breakfast meeting this morning breakfast meeting. Jesus Christ, I've been doing too much business.
Speaking of breakfast, did you know that other cultures will eat like five meals a day? They'll have like breakfast, 11 C's, lunch, supper, and dinner.
Yeah, that's pretty standard.
Yeah. Pretty cool stuff.
Why?
Like hobbits. Hobbits do
how
that.
Many meals
they have
do
even
you
more
eat?
Meals. They have second breakfast as well. Speaking of hobbits, you know, Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. just practicing.
It took me a while there to realize what you were doing. You're getting much better at this, Ryan. Okay,
right, let's talk
so
about
today
sanctions.
We're talking
Goddamn.
About sanctions. Okay, before we get started with the discussion on the history and the political power of sanctions, I just wanted to point out that sanction has two meanings. The first is to gain the approval of someone in authority, while the second definition is to have a non-corporeal barrier put in place by someone in authority. Now, if we take a look at the etymology of the word, and please, that's etymology, not entomology. We are not talking about the insect words,
well,
world
we could be.
Of words. We could be, but we're not, okay? If we take a look at the etymology of the word sanction, the dual meaning actually becomes a little clearer because it was originally intended to denote an ecclesiastical decree. To sanction implies to make a legal agreement. And the word is derived from the Latin sanctus, or to make holy. So the original authority that could sanction stuff was the church, specifically the Christian church. So, now that we've gotten into
So like when the U.S. sanctions someone, they're basically like forcing them to the forcing other people to follow the order of His Holiness capitalism.
Yes, that's exactly the point I'm going for. Sanctions, although they are denominated in various different forms, you've got economic sanctions, military sanctions, or the blah, 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 blah. You've got all these different kinds of sanctions. Technically, they all boil down to economic sanctions because there's no way to enforce anything other than economically by restricting trade on specific items and that kind of thing. We'll get into that in a second. And in that sense, sanctions essentially become a religious thing then, where in this case, the religion is capitalism. And either you adhere to the capitalist mantras and prayers and holy books, or you get sanctioned.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of fun.
I was trying to think of that word, the sacraments?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the word I was trying to think of. I don't know religious terminology because I've never, ever been religious for even 1 second in my life.
Yeah, Ryan doesn't know how to religion, which is a good thing. but at the same time, it's very limiting in some regards.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does
miss,
mean
like,
that
I miss like every biblical reference that anyone ever makes. Like, oh yeah, it's just like when Peter took the goats down to the market and you know, God,
I want to be very, you know,
gave him a sack of milk. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I want to be very clear. I am in the Middle East, and I did not take the goats anywhere. Okay, that wasn't me, and what happened to them had nothing to do with me.
Yeah, well, I was talking about Peter, the Bible guy, Saint Peter.
I don't think he
Prince
was saint
Prince
back
Peter.
Then. I think he got sanctified much later.
Okay, I don't even know what that means.
Of course you don't, because you're a heathen. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's get going. So, let's start. Just by defining economic sanction real quick, we don't need to get into a really complicated definition, but because we have a lot of examples to cover. So economic sanctions are defined as the withdrawal of customary trade and financial relations for foreign and security policy purposes. They may be comprehensive, prohibiting commercial activity with regard to an entire country, like the longstanding U.S. embargo of Cuba. Or they may be targeted, blocking transactions of and with particular businesses, groups, or individuals. And I'll point out that sanctions and embargoes are kind of the same. An embargo is like a more severe version of a sanction. And then a blockade is also similar, but a blockade is like physically preventing trade, and it's usually considered an act of war.
Yes, like that time that the Empire had a blockade over Tatooine.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Or like that time that that only democracy in the Middle East made a blockade of the open-air prison that they built. That would be another example.
Yeah, that one.
Yep. All right, so which one should we start with? We have Iran, Korea, and COCOM. So what should we start with?
I think let's start with COCOM.
Okay.
Just to give a bit of background. Obviously, the COCOM is... I don't even mention them in my notes about Iran and North Korea and stuff. But yeah, I think COCOM is a very interesting place to start.
Cool. So COCOM is an abbreviation for Coordinating Committee for Multilateral Export Controls. And the whole thing was basically from the end of World War II to a few years after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a coordinated, like a, basically a cartel among capitalist countries to heavily restrict trade with communist countries. And the main target of this was military technology. But the U.S., who was the main country that ran COCOM, had a very loose definition of what constitutes a military technology, because they included stuff like computers in there. So the U.S., U.K., and France were the core of COCOM. It began operating on January 1st, 1950, with the addition of Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. And then soon after that, Norway, Denmark, Canada, and West Germany joined. And by 1953, Portugal, Japan, Greece, and Turkey joined. So this was like a really huge cartel of a bunch of different countries. Mm-hmm. Some countries refused to formally join, including Sweden, Switzerland, Iceland, Austria, and Finland. But none of them actually wanted to take a stance against it. So it was more like inconsistent informal participation than actual non-participation or outright resistance.
It's so typical for Switzerland.
Yeah. They're happy to take everyone's money and, you know, provide them with like indirect assistance, but they won't get involved directly.
Yeah, basically they're the ones that like to sell the sticks so that all the other stakeholders can beat each other with them.
Slippery snakes. During the Korean War, which is still going on, hopefully not by the time this airs, but maybe still. During the Korean War, a separate coordinating committee was started for China and North Korea, and the restrictions were even more severe than those on the USSR and Eastern Bloc. But in 1957, it was eliminated, and the sanctions were just merged into COCOM. So COCOM is technically not a formal organization. It's not based on a treaty or executive agreement or anything like that. So the organization itself has no power to enforce its mandates. The only reason that it worked is because all of the countries involved sort of agreed that it was something that was important to have. So even though COCOM couldn't enforce anything, each country was using its own like export restriction apparatus, I guess, to implement the restrictions laid out by COCOM. Go ahead.
Sounds a little bit like Bilderberg.
I don't know about that, and I tend to stay away from it because it sounds like an evil Jew conspiracy.
Oh, Bilderberg? No, Bilderberg's an actual meeting that happens.
Yeah, I know it's an actual meeting that happens, but it sounds to me like there's not a lot of evidence about what it actually is other than like, ooh, it's a secret meeting and the name is Jewy. I don't know.
I don't even know what constitutes a Jewish name.
<It's> like, that. If it ends with Berg, it's probably Jewish. Especially
two
icebergs. People who hate Jews. They will just take any Berg name as Jewish.
Do they tend to destroy icebergs too?
Yeah. Icebergs.
The Titanic the Titanic was a Jewish conspiracy, I tell you.
All right. Shit. Where was I? COCOM largely operated as a secretive organization, almost on the level of a conspiracy, since it was legally or politically incompatible with some countries' stated trade policies. And the original intent was for post-war aid to act as a lever of enforcement. So, like the aid that the U.S. was giving to Western European countries, since in 1949, the U.S. aid to Western Europe was over $6 billion compared to the total trade volume of $1.8 billion. But that quickly became sort of toothless because U.S. aid kind of trickled away.
That's unadjusted?
Yeah, I think that's nominal.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a massive amount.
Yeah. So the COCOM list contains military items and nuclear materials, which was the part that was not disputed by members at all. So everyone agreed that military equipment and nukes should be kept away from communist countries. but there are also dual use items, which amount to, if you look at the list, basically just like all industrial equipment. So like anything that's a useful tool on a large scale would be included in the dual use items, because technically any industrial equipment can be used to make weapons.
So before we carry on, just very quickly, can we now surmise that the next time someone says to me, well, why didn't communism work? You know, if it's such a great system, how come it never worked? Can I then point them at COCOM?
Oh, yeah.
Just
yeah,
say, look,
for sure.
This is one of the major reasons why.
Yeah, and I mean, if it's not a big deal, you know, like, if you show this to someone and you're like, oh, well, is that all it took? It's like, well, if it's not such a big deal, then why was there such an importance placed on it? Like, why did all of these countries agree that it was necessary to keep this stuff from the communists? And, you know, if it isn't such a big deal, then, you know, why didn't they just give them the stuff? You know, if it didn't help or hurt that much, then, you know, wouldn't it be in the capitalist country's interest to have more exports? You know,
No, you can't trade with commies. I mean, Jesus.
No. you might catch their communism. I was actually thinking about this yesterday in world history class for us. When they talked about like the Vietnam War, they talked about this thing called domino theory, which was like this U.S. foreign policy thing where like they basically wouldn't let any country become communist because the theory was that like one communist country would cause all the others around it to topple and become communist too. And they
oh
kind of
God.
Portrayed it. They portrayed it as like this thing that like, oh, well, you know, that's what we thought back then, but we were, you know, kind of foolish about it, instead of like, no, that was an aggressive policy, like intentionally aimed at preventing a single communist country from existing.
So their theory was literally that communism is such a desirable system that we don't want it to take root anywhere because it's almost guaranteed that other countries will adopt it.
Yes, but they didn't put it that way at all.
No, of course yeah. not, of course not. But the implication is there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like a wider thing that like any like unequivocally evil shit that the U.S. does, when we tell other Americans about it, we just portray it as like, oh, well, we were just being silly and stupid, you know, but we've learned since then. That's like the excuse for anything.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that no, they haven't learned from anything. But that's for another show. That's for another show. Regulations were not as strict in allied countries as in the U.S. itself. And that American businesses in industries regulated by COCOM felt that the regulations gave businesses in allied countries a competitive advantage.
This is a little confusing. So the U.S. restrictions on exports were much, much stricter because the U.S. had a much stronger interest in preventing communist countries from becoming powerful. So they were the ones that had most of those dual use items. They had like the most comprehensive list. And so because each country was restricting, was enforcing these export controls on their own, you know, just based on the COCOM guidelines, the U.S. had the most restrictive export controls. So U.S. businesses were the least able to export items to communist countries.
So this was basically COCOM saying America first?
Well, I was saying communism last. capitalism first. But the European businesses were much more liberal about what they would allow to be exported. And so that ended up causing U.S. businesses to just use their European subsidiaries, which were in less regulated countries, to export the items that they weren't able to export from their U.S.-based businesses. And the European countries complained that they were often doing this with European credit. So they were like getting a double advantage, sort of.
Okay. Okay.
Let's see, where were we there?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so the negotiations for like the COCOM list, like deciding what should be controlled and what shouldn't, were usually informal, which allowed it to operate effectively without resistance from opposing interests. So one of the big things about COCOM was like everyone knew that making it public would cause like a lot of backlash, because there would, you know, there'd be political resistance, there'd be resistance from businesses that want fewer export controls on themselves, and there would just be generally like a demand for there to be an actual like proper political process to decide, you know, whether or not this is a legitimate thing to do, whether it's a legitimate organization to have. So they kept it as informal and secretive as possible, because any sort of formalization would force a public debate, or you know, would force them to contend with the business interests that opposed this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, in doing research for this episode, looking for the details on actual sanctions, it, unless you go directly to government sources, there's almost nothing. There's a lot of opinion about sanctions mm-hmm. that very vaguely refer to specific sanctions in place, but there's it's really difficult as a layman, as an average person, to gain detailed information on specific sanctions in place. And given the fact that sanctions are actually, like, from a legal standpoint, they're extremely complex.
I was trying to look up yesterday, like, how is a sanction actually enforced? Like, what if you're trying to export a banned item, like, what happens? And I didn't spend too long on it, but, you know, from what I can gather, it seems sort of like they just have, I guess they have, you know, trade records, like they have you declare what you're exporting. And then, like, they probably do inspections to make sure, like, random inspections to make sure people aren't, like, lying about it. But other than that, like, it's kind of on the business to declare what they're exporting. And
Yeah. Very definitely that's how it works. I know this because, and I'll mention this later when I chat a little bit about ZTE. I don't know if you heard about Trump stating that he intends to save ZTE before they fail.
I don't know what that is.
ZTE is a Chinese telecom company. They're one of the biggest in the world. And the idea is that they've been struggling financially. And even throughout the this trade war, even with this trade war with China and all the tariff arguments and everything, Trump stood up and said he will make sure that they don't go under. And everyone was very shocked by this. And since then...
Trump's a Chinese nationalist now. He must have watched Ip Man.
So after this came out... it's since been revealed that ZTE broke sanctions in trading with both Iran and with North Korea. And they've been given a $1.5 billion fine. And part of the sanctions and the penalties that they have to do is they have to replace their entire board. And their stock price has tanked by about 40% in the last 3-4 weeks because they agreed to these sanctions penalties. And when you take into account the fact that ZTE is one of the biggest companies in China, and was very closely controlled by the Chinese government. The fact that they're willing to go through this just says a lot about how trade negotiations work and how willing they are to trade with the U.S. that they're willing to take on a $1.5 billion fine, which is, to be honest, a lot bigger than most of the banks paid for the 2007 crash. But what's pissed everyone off is that they're willing to replace the entire board. Yeah. And that hasn't gone down so well.
Yeah. Sounds like it's too big to fail or something.
Kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Where were we?
Yeah. So back to COCOM being like a kind of a secretive organization. So the Germans believed that trying to make COCOM into a formal organization would cause it to collapse, like I said, because it would have to be openly discussed and justified, which they did not see something that would be likely to succeed. And the French actually objected to the very structure of COCOM, so they were probably the most against how it was actually set up, because they would rather just have a set of guidelines and like complete autonomy to apply them themselves instead of having like this coordination between countries. They just wanted like these are the types of things that would be considered military technologies, and then they would just have autonomy. So let's see. German officials also felt that COCOM was extremely important for managing the Japanese economy, because as they put it, Japan wouldn't think much of exporting military technology to Eastern Bloc countries so far away. But this is confusing to me because, like, Japan is closest to the USSR, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty much one little ocean gap, very small ocean gap away from the Korean Peninsula and by extension connection to Russia. So
yeah, and if you think that the USSR is a threat, then wouldn't the USSR, like, wouldn't Russia proper be more threatening than the Eastern Bloc countries that are just sort of like satellite nations there? I don't know. It's weird. Also seems kind of like infantilizing to me. Like generally the way they talk about Japan in this, it seems like they afford them the least agency of all the countries. Like every other country, they talk about what the country's officials think about stuff, and like for Japan, they don't really mention that at all. They're like, oh yeah, there's like general sentiments in Japan about blah blah blah, but they don't have like, oh yeah, their important officials said this and they have this opinion. And
well, I suppose that I mean, we are talking about 1950s and a little bit later, and Japan really wasn't very open to the world at that point. Probably not that easy to get an actual reading on what is actually going on in Japan. You know, they didn't really understand.
Yeah, this is from 1979, though. So this is like when Japan was really up and coming and
had started opening up to the world. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because like, you know, in the 80s, they were the biggest country to trade with, or they were like the hottest country to trade with, rather. So.
Oh my god, you guys, are you guys trading with Japan? I would totally trade with Japan. Oh my god. Sorry, that was...
no, I totally lost my place.
That's exactly where you are.
So, the French noted that COCOM's main purpose is to limit technology transfer, and that COCOM functions as like a gentleman's club, which I think is a hilariously perverted metaphor. the main purpose,
who's the stripper?
Russia, I guess. I don't know. that's who it is, Russia. So the main purpose is to limit technology transfer. So like, it wasn't even just that they were trying to prevent communist countries from becoming like militarily threatening or like having the capability of, you know, starting a war against the Western countries. They actually like wanted to hinder their technological development and like keep them behind. I mean, that's probably part of the same purpose, but I'm sure there's also an element of, like, we need to make sure that everyone knows that capitalism is better than communism involved in there.
I think as subtext, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. France was blamed the most for violations of COCOM. They were, you know, accused of exporting technologies the most. But the French accused both the British and Americans of being very eager to violate export controls. They said American, this is what I mentioned earlier. They said American businesses would use European subsidiaries to export under the less stringent regulations and use European credit to do so. And the U.S. also has the additional advantage of being in the highest demand by the USSR. So, like, Soviet traders wanted U.S. technology more than any others. So, so they had a double advantage there. They also point out that a country at a technological disadvantage can object to the export of a technology until they catch up and have that technology themselves, and then they'll switch to being in favor of exporting.
Mm.
And there was another effect that was sort of like that someone else pointed out, which was that some countries would object to exporting a technology that other countries were thinking about, like, establishing industries on. And as soon as the other countries, like, sort of lost interest, then they would switch and then start exporting it so that they would have an advantage for themselves. So kind of two sides of the same coin there.
Yeah.
Finally, from France, the French tip their hand and reveal that they're actually libertarians. So they say the French agree that that commercial rivalry can be one of the best guarantees against exporting the most sophisticated technology to the USSR, and a more effective deterrent than COCOM. The desire to secure French jobs through exports and maintain good relations with communist nations is shared by all elements of their political spectrum. So they think the free market should just take care of it.
The invisible hand generally does take care of everything. It is all-powerful and omnipotent and omniscient.
Yeah. And their invisible hand is holding a cigarette, so.
Saying, fuck the French, America, fuck America.
I will export to the Soviets if I want to.
Don't tell me what to do, America, and COCOM, and don't give a fuck. Now bring me some champagne. Yeah,
Japan
so...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, you sounded like you were struggling a little bit, so I was going to take over for a bit.
I'm all right. Japan was most expected to resist COCOM, despite having reasons other than strategic global dominance to be concerned about the USSR and PRC, People's Republic of China. There was also no real push against them since there was, like, in Japan, there was a Japanese Communist Party, and they were pro-USSR. But at that time, there was also a Japanese Socialist Party, and they were anti-USSR. And on top of that, Japan has had a right-wing government basically, like, for the entirety of the 20th and 21st century. So there was not much worry in them wanting to ally with the USSR. So overall, all countries agreed that the USSR and PRC were their enemies and shouldn't be given military technology. But there was less agreement on what non-military technologies should be restricted. And again, U.S. businesses were the most restricted under COCOM. And I'm just going to read this passage directly from this article that I've been reading, because it's a pretty interesting, like, specific case of COCOM.
Sweet. Go for it.
All right. In November 1962, the United States attempted to impede the completion of the Friendship oil pipeline from the USSR to Eastern Europe by preventing its allies from exporting large diameter steel pipe to the Soviet bloc. So that's one of those things where, like, it's basically any industry, any industrial equipment is considered like a military technology or, you know, politically important technology that needs to be on the COCOM list. The pipe embargo order was passed in NATO because the United States knew that the British would not agree to it in COCOM. Several instructive points emerged from this attempt to prevent export from the to the USSR. Washington was able to prevail on the West German government to force several German corporations to cancel already concluded deals for the sale of pipe. This naturally caused an outcry in the German business community. However, since the United States did not have as much political leverage over its other allies as it did over Bonn, I don't know what that is, it was unable to prevent Great Britain, Italy, or Japan, which of course was not in NATO, from selling similar pipe to the USSR. Britain in particular chose to ignore the NATO directive. Ultimately, not only did the USSR find alternative sources of supply for pipe, but the embargo induced it to step up its own The embargo induced it to step up the development of its own pipe making capacity. The completion of the Friendship pipeline was delayed by only a year as a result of the embargo. Moreover, there was strong suspicion in most European capitals that the real American motivation for the embargo was not fear of enhancing Soviet military capabilities, but rather the wariness of U.S. oil companies about the USSR dumping cheap oil on the Western European market. Whatever the truth is of this allegation, and it may well have been utterly unfounded, it made a powerful argument. The net result of the pipe embargo was damage to U.S.-West European relations and only a marginal effect on the Soviet ability to complete an oil pipeline that supplied the Red Army troops in Eastern Europe.
Okay, for the record, just quickly, Bonn is a city in Germany.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I think that's pretty interesting, especially the part about U.S. oil companies having an interest in preventing it, because that kind of fits with, Bickler-Nitzan's research on energy conflicts being, predictable by U.S. oil company differential revenue gains.
Agreed. Agreed. I mean, obviously, it also plays towards sabotage.
It also makes me wonder why, why didn't the USSR create a glut of oil? Because that could easily have made Western economies, if not tank momentarily, at least become brittle.
My immediate response would be that it's unlikely that USSR political economists and advisors to the regime would have understood capitalist economics well enough to be able to say, well, create a glut of oil. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if they understood it's entirely what possible understand that, now about full cost pricing and how important the price of oil is to a national economy.
Exactly. From their perspective, I mean, Marx had essentially led them down the wrong road of thinking of the means of production as capital. Mm-hmm. And if your entire economy is founded on that principle, you're not going to understand how capitalization by the West actually functions. So, right. Yeah, thanks, Marx.
Yeah, especially, it wasn't even fully understood by capitalist countries themselves until, probably around this time.
Yeah. No,
capital asset pricing model, I think, was, 1950s? And then General McNamara was the general that brought the idea of capitalization to U.S. military appropriations. So, I don't know if it was just Marx, or if it was, no one really understood some of the aspects of capitalism that we understand now.
It's probably no one, but I'm going to blame Marx anyway.
Okay.
So COCOM was then essentially an international cartel that managed to last quite a few years after the USSR fell.
Yeah. So even with, countries kind of acting on their own, even with examples like that pipeline thing, which kind of damaged relations, and even with countries disagreeing on what COCOM should actually be, and like France thinking that it should just be a, you know, a set of standards and that countries should just have total autonomy. It was still a really resilient cartel. And I think it's a good counterexample against that whole cartels can't really last because that, you know, some self-interested party will break the cartel and cause it to collapse sort of narrative that, that the free market people put out there.
Okay, and COCOM finally ceased to function in March 31st of 1994. But I can't remember now. I was reading something and I forgot to save the link that mentioned, and I can't remember now. Most of the sanctions that, international sanctions that we see now are done through the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And the United Nations has been around long before the end of COCOM, but I can't seem to find when sanctions started being pushed through the UN.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the UN is also basically just a U.S. organization.
Yeah, so yeah.
Both COCOM and the UN were the main bodies of sanctions, and they were both almost entirely controlled by the U.S.
Yeah. So either way, when COCOM sort of died, at least they still had the UN to deal with.
Yeah. Okay, so that's COCOM. What do we have
okay.
next?
Okay. Next, I'd like to talk just basically quickly about international sanctions and how they come in different flavors, okay. None of which are very tasty. Sorry, I have a new policy that I will tell a minimum of 3 dad jokes per episode because they are truly a strength for me.
Yeah.
It's something I'm proud of and I will never back down from. Okay, so international sanctions, they come in different forms. You've got diplomatic sanctions, such as the ending of diplomatic relations with Qatar by the rest of the Gulf Cooperation Council nations last year. And those diplomatic sanctions are still ongoing. And diplomatic sanctions tend to force isolationism, which tends then to go on to strengthen the nation in question as it has no option but to figure out how to make do without the international relationships it had before the sanctions. Again, I'm going to refer to Qatar, who have actually, they've flourished under the sanctions and the current situation. They've developed underground farms and stuff. Their entire system is basically pretty strong. They're not suffering from the sanctions as they exist today. So even though my wife very much doesn't like them,
Borat.
And at the end of the day, all of this is, obviously, it's all political. But, I mean, I grew up in South Africa in the closing stages of apartheid. And under apartheid, we had very heavy international diplomatic, military, economic sanctions across the board for several decades. And because of those sanctions, South Africa was forced to rely on itself. For the most part. And because of that, we had some of the most sought-after medical technologies on the planet. Our doctors and nurses were world-renowned. A lot of our civil engineers, a lot of our mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, very, very sought-after globally. And this is something that isolationism tends to do, especially when it's enforced by the international community. We look at cases like Japan, who had cultural isolationism as a standard.
Yes,
you know,
had.
They shut themselves off. Yeah, had where they shut themselves off from the rest of the world, and because of that, their culture got to develop internally without the kind of pollution by international cultures. You find that by the time they did open their borders up and they started interacting with the world, by then they had started heading in very different directions from a technological standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, from a political standpoint.
From an anime standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, my God. You go look at Western animation versus Japanese animation, and there's just no comparison. sorry, it's obligatory for us to mention anime whenever it's possible.
Yep.
Diplomatic sanctions basically have the effect of creating isolationism. I didn't do enough research on military sanctions. I got lazy.
I literally did one section, so.
there's a lot of different military sanctions around the world. They get leveled for all sorts of things. It's people tend to think, oh no, humanitarian issues, military sanctions. But they're also used for a range of other things. Obviously, the most obvious one at the moment is the ongoing arms embargoes against Syria for humanitarian issues. But they're by no means the only one. Very many African countries, several Southeast Asian countries, some South American countries. Noticeably missing from this is American, North American countries. For some reason, there's no sanctions against Canada and the U.S. specifically when it comes to military, even though there are ongoing human rights violations. Anyway, next up is individual sanctions, which the U.S. Treasury refers to as follows, and I'm quoting this verbatim. As part of its enforcement efforts, the OFAC publishes a list of individuals and companies owned or controlled by or acting for or on behalf of targeted countries. It also lists individuals, groups, and entities such as terrorists and narcotics traffickers designated under programs that are not country-specific. Collectively, such individuals and companies are called Specially Designated Nationals, or SDNs. Their assets are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from dealing with them. Now, for the record, and I've included this list in our show notes, this list has hundreds of thousands of names on it from virtually every country on the planet. I thought I'd check it out. I'm not on the list, thank goodness. I'm allowed to legally trade with the U.S. So Ryan is safe. But there really is the I cracked myself when I saw how long the list is. The list that I've added in is a text list that is sorted by country alphabetically, and it is extensive.
Yeah, I've been scrolling. I've been holding the page down key since you started talking about it, and I'm not even a quarter way through.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. And this is actually enforced. There's a department within the U.S. Treasury that keeps track of all of this shit.
Yeah, I like the idea that there's like some bureaucrat that's got this file open, and they just do Control F and like type someone's name in. And like that's how they enforce this thing.
do a credit check on this person.
All right, I just made it to halfway through the file, so it is very long. Mostly Arabic names, shockingly.
Shocking.
I wonder why that is.
I wonder if those people are on a no travel list. Finally, we have environmental sanctions, which are really just economic sanctions that are supposed to encourage cooperation and compliance with international environmental agreements, such as the Paris Climate Agreement.
So we know those don't do anything.
Yeah. In September of 2017, Achim Hagen and Jan Schneider of Humboldt University in Berlin, Germany, looked at the efficacy of environmental sanctions and found that, and I'm going to just quote the conclusion from their study. In spite of scientific agreement on the negative effects of anthropogenic climate change, efforts to find cooperative solutions on the international level have been unsatisfactory so far. Trade sanctions in the form of import tariffs are one principal measure discussed as a means to foster cooperation. Former studies have concluded that import tariffs are an effective mechanism to establish international cooperation. However, most of these studies rely on the assumption that outsiders are not able to retaliate, i.e., to implement import tariffs themselves. In this paper, we use combined analytical and numerical analyses, analysis, to investigate implications of retaliation. We find a threshold effect. Below a certain coalition size, the effect of retaliation predominates and decreases incentives to be a coalition member. In coalitions above the threshold size, the effect of trade sanctions that stabilizes coalitions dominates and enables the formation of larger stable coalitions. Our analysis suggests that only after a sufficiently large climate coalition has already been formed will the threat of trade sanctions be effective, be an effective stick to establish the grand coalition. So until enough people agree, the sanctions don't really work because it's just back and forth people saying, oh, well, fine, you want to impose tariffs on us? We'll impose tariffs on you too. And that's pretty much what we see the Trump administration and the Trudeau administration and then Macron and everyone just, you know, we're all going to tariff each other.
I don't know. I think crippling global trade would actually be pretty good for climate change.
God, it would be nice. But again, I'm not sure if it actually works out that way.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so
let's skip over the pragmatic section. I don't think we need to touch on that.
Okay, but this is like the most important study that I found.
Okay.
Did you read what I wrote there?
I read the first sentence and then decided.
No. Okay, so if you go look up pragmatic.
Very diminutive sentence there.
If you go look up pragmatic sanctions on Wikipedia or whatever, it'll tell you that it specifically refers to how monarchs throughout history use their authority to compel compliance from various classes of their subjects and other monarchs. So instead of looking at how sanctions used to work, I'm asking, are they pragmatic now? Are they practical in our current day and age? So do sanctions work? Now, in a 2014 working paper written by Lee Jones and Clara Portella from the Center for the Study of Global Security and Development at the Queen Mary University of London, they took a close look at the academic literature on the success of sanctions and they concluded, we ought to be more critical. If we find, for example, that sanctions are successful in delivering sender-related goals like rallying populations for war and system-related goals like corralling allies into confrontational postures and branding weak states as rogues and outlaws, but unsuccessful at delivering target-related goals except punishment, this ought to be cause for concern, not grist to the mill for sanctions optimists. It would imply that individual states are being singled out to enable militaristic and imperialistic strategies of global governance. At their worst, there is no doubt that sanctions have been used for this purpose, turning them into weapons of mass destruction, and their senders into de facto war criminals. Despite their posturing as the upholders of international right and justice, what the sanctions literature needs most of all, perhaps, is a healthy dose of skepticism about the high-minded motives of sender states. That, to me, is one of the greatest passages I've ever read in academic literature.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically what they're saying is sanctions work. They definitely work, but only if you measure effectiveness by the standards of global militaristic and imperialistic governance. They work if you are America trying to take over the Middle East and control the oil flow there.
Yeah, so their stated purpose by the countries using them of being for humanitarian ends, to prevent humanitarian crises. They don't work for that, but they do work for global political strategy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So with that in mind, let's have a quick word on the sanctions on Iran.
Quick, yes.
When I say, yeah, because we are running a bit long, aren't we? How far? Okay.
We're an hour and 18 in, but I think like 20 minutes of that was sound testing stuff. So.
And okay, cool.
And
okay,
also the 10 or 15 or 20 seconds that I spent explaining this.
I wasn't expecting that. Okay. There is a long history of sanctions against Iran. I asked Ryan when we were doing the notes for this, well, Ryan, what can I do to help? Because he was like, oh, sanctions are so complicated and boring, and I don't know, like, the research isn't fun. So I was like, well, let me help out, buddy. What can I do? And he's like, could you maybe do Iran? And I was like, yeah, of course. And I started looking into sanctions.
Yeah, I was
Iran.
Like, oh, this is a really specific topic that would be good and interesting and relevant. Probably won't be that hard to figure out, right?
Okay, so I'm not going to go into the full history of sanctions against Iran. It is a very, very detailed and a complicated issue. Yeah, there's way too much to cover. So instead, I'm just going to briefly go over what we can expect from the current sanctions and the current political situation involving Iran. A 2008 study by the National Foreign Trade Council estimated that normalization of trade with Iran by lifting the UN mandated sanctions that were in place at the time could reduce the global oil price by as much as 10% and obviously then inject much needed foreign investment in Iran. Now, for those of you that have been paying attention to us for the last few months, a 10% reduction in the oil price globally, that is huge.
Yep.
That's massive. That literally would uplift the lives of the entire global population. Also had the knock-on effect of speeding up global warming, but we're not going to talk about that. Now, this argument that it would reduce the oil price is often countered with the argument that if Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, the regional relations would break down and cause an increase in the oil price and eventually trigger another global recession.
High oil prices, that thing that causes recessions.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
What? The main reason why I disagree with this thought process of if Iran gets nuclear weapons or a nuclear weapon, then it would break down regional relations and cause the oil price to spike up so high that eventually we get a global recession. The problem with that is it works on the assumption that nuclear weapons are tactical in the sense that they will ever be used in war. They've only ever been used in war once, and the whole world was so appalled by that we then had the mutually assured destruction protocols put in place globally.
Yeah, and
literally a
bunch of trees.
If Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon and then launch it at, let's say, Israel, the moment that it leaves a silo, about 20 seconds later, Iran would be wiped off the face of the earth. There's no doubt about this from anyone, including Iran. They're not that stupid. Really, they're not stupid at all. They've got some of the most intelligent people in the world living and working there. So the idea that it's used as, that it would be used as a tactical weapon is ridiculous. It is and always has been a strategic political weapon.
Yeah, it's a deterrent against the U.S. invading your country.
Yeah, please notice that countries that have nuclear weapons do not get invaded by America, ever. Okay, so we all know that Donald Trump pulled out of the agreement with Iran, and that it has caused all sorts of ructions within the global political community. But we have to ask the question of how will the latest sanctions against Iran, how are those going to work out? So this is the basic structure of things. Again, sanctions are extremely complicated, and to get into them in the kind of detail that would explain everything to you so that you are an expert on them, that's not going to happen on this show ever. I don't have 5 days to spend talking about it. So just very basically, in a first step, companies must wind down holdings of Iranian sovereign debt or Iranian currency by the 6th of August this year. By that date, any person or company that assists the Iranian government with acquiring or purchasing U.S. dollar banknotes will be subject to sanctions. Reimposed by that date will also be sanctions targeting Iran's trade in gold and other precious metals, graphite and coal, metals such as aluminium and steel. Sorry, you guys call it aluminium, hey? it'll also affect the country's automobile sector and luxury products such as Iranian origin carpets and caviar. Then, in a second phase that starts on the 4th of November, sanctions against Iran's oil industry will be reinstated, including penalties against foreign financial institutions that conduct significant transactions with the Central Bank of Iran. On top of that, the U.S. is targeting petroleum-related transactions, essentially punishing companies doing business with Iranian oil firms such as National Iranian Oil Company, Naftiran, who's
Naftiran Intertrade Company.
Yeah, that's it. And the National Iranian Tanker Company. And while some might think that rising oil price might benefit Iran, this simply isn't true. Because Iran is going to need to use more of its oil locally. The reasons for this are twofold. First, the sanctions will essentially prevent most of the oil from leaving Iran in the first place, especially since Total, who had signed a $5 billion deal to develop the largest reserve in Iran, have already pulled out.
They Total didn't want to take corporation?
Yeah, they're like Exxon and BP. They're one of the top global oil companies.
It's weird. I've never heard of them before.
They're massive in South Africa. Surprised you've never heard of them. Anyway,
what if they
so
own Total Wine?
I don't know. Check it out. Check it out.
Probably not.
Okay. Yeah, probably not. But who knows? They had signed a $5 billion deal to invest in Iran, and they've already pulled out because they don't want to risk the sanctions. Then, second, and for me the most important, the sanctions are going to affect a large part of the $4 billion in renewable energy projects that Iran has signed with various European countries. If these deals are scrapped, Iran will be forced to use its oil locally for energy production. And that's not so much fun. Now, it's important to note that the sanctions on Iran are the heaviest sanctions ever leveled against anyone. And they have been for quite a while.
Yeah, it seems like they're just trying to prevent them from doing trade of any kind.
Yeah, very much so. And they extend much further than barring oil exports. But it's also important to note that sanctions are rarely about punishing a nation for the specific reasons stated in the sanctions themselves, like we mentioned earlier. In Iran's case, the sanctions are not really about nuclear weapons or about humanitarian rights and wrongs. They are very much about exerting influence in the political dynamics of the Middle East and about geopolitics in general. As I mentioned earlier with the ZTE stuff, ZTE has dealt with Iran, and because of that, they've been given a fine and they've been told to restructure their entire company. specifically the board has to be completely replaced. And they're happy to do it so that they can keep their trade relations going. Now, Congress has opposed this deal that Trump has said he would go into with ZTE, and they're trying to enact bipartisan legislation to block it. But at this stage, it doesn't even matter because Trump has already achieved the desired result of showing himself to be pro-business with China. So there we go, sanctions doing their job, even though they don't do the job that they say they're doing.
Right.
Finally, very quickly on the sanctions on North Korea, which, if Trump is to be believed, will be lifted in the near future. Then if you go listen to Pompeo, that's not going to happen until you have complete denuclearization. And if history is anything to go by.
Yeah, the new theory that I've gathered from right-wing Twitter is that Trump's plan with this peace negotiation is to basically create American jobs by opening trade with North Korea and putting U.S. businesses in the country, which seems pretty optimistic to me.
That has to be the biggest overstatement ever. Okay, so Trump and Kim have become best buddies overnight by signing what the liberals have been calling a huge nothing burger, which is the funniest thing I've ever heard. Like, what? What the fuck is a nothing burger?
Dude, this whole peace negotiation process has made me hate liberals so fucking much. Like, they're just being like so petty and factional that like they're basically cheering on the continuation of a, you know, 70-year war just so Trump doesn't score any political points.
But it's hilarious to me because Obama, he signed an even bigger nothing burger with North Korea, which included a moratorium on its nuclear program in exchange for food aid. And the food came, but the moratorium didn't stop the development of nukes. And the Democrat before him, Clinton, actually gave North Korea two light nuclear fuel plants.
Wow, like, so legitimizing the most brutal dictator on the planet, putting them at the same level as the United States?
Dude, they literally went in and built the plants for them and everything.
Yeah.
And look, I'm not partisan here. He also conceded food aid in exchange for promises to not build nukes. So basically, the whole North Korea sanctions and presidential deals thing, it's political theatrics.
Yeah, man, it's almost like there's a whole population of humans that live in North Korea, and it's not just Kim Jong-un and the North Korean army who are a bunch of, you know, psychopathic automatons that just want to murder Americans. It's crazy.
So, and I'm not so sure that that's true. I think they are all Kim Jong Il, Un Il Sung, and I don't know anymore. They're all clones of him and his sister. Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so the very last thing that I want to cover is how to deal with sanctions in the most appropriate way. This came, my wife asked me this.
Nukes.
Very literally. My wife asked me this morning what our topic is for the podcast today. And I told her we're doing sanctions, and she was like, "Oh, well, I don't think sanctions work." And I was like, "Yeah, well, I've got research that agrees with you." And she was like, "Yeah, no, but what I mean is, India was developing nuclear technology, and the US said, 'No, you can't do that here, sanctions.' And India looked at the US and said, Yeah, so fuck you. We don't care. I wasn't even aware of what she was talking about. So I went and I looked it up, and she was 100% correct. This happened under Jimmy Carter, and basically, India had this was right after the Indo-Pak War, and India had basically figured out that it needs to be self-reliant if it was going to survive international relations.
What war is this?
Indo-Pakistan. India and Pakistan, they really don't like each other.
I know nothing about this war. Well, I know that part, but...
Yeah. So, yeah, there's been... It's the fight over Kashmir for the most part, and it's complicated. Maybe we can do an episode on it in the future or mention it in an episode on war or whatever. But to break this down just very quickly, the plutonium used in the test of some nuclear weapons developed by India in what they dubbed a peaceful nuclear explosion. And I love this. The project was codenamed Smiling Buddha. and basically, New Delhi claimed that it was not a weapon. And this was back in 1974. The plutonium used in that test was created by the Cyrus reactor, which was supplied by Canada and using heavy water supplied by the United States. And when the U.S. figured this out, they were like, no, you can't do this. You can't do that. You need to sign the non-proliferation agreement. And India was like, no, we're not going to do that. We have a right to develop nuclear weapons and nuclear technologies, and we're going to do that anyway. And the U.S. responded by saying, no, we are going to impose heavy sanctions on you. And they did. And they put those sanctions out there. I'm assuming through COCOM as well. Although...
I don't think so, because it wouldn't be an Eastern Bloc country.
Yeah, I'm just quickly looking up to see... No, they did it through the UN. Okay, so they put these sanctions in place, but they hadn't really figured out that none of the sanctions were going to work, because the US at that stage had almost no trade with India. And India they didn't care about sanctions, because nothing that they imported came through any of the allies of the US or US trade partners. And for the most part, India was self-sufficient. So, if you want to survive sanctions, this episode has taught you, be self-sufficient, stop trading internationally, and develop some nukes.
Yeah. Just be a country with a billion people in it.
Yeah. And that is our episode on sanctions.
That was a lot tighter than I thought it would be.
Woohoo! It's when I write the show notes that we bang through things. You know?
Yeah, we have 8 pages of notes for people listening. And yeah. We've had much longer shows based on like 2 pages of notes. So,
Do you know why? Because I wasn't letting you get sidetracked today, and I kept a tight leash on you.
Yes, that's what happened. All right. So that was our show. If you liked it, subscribe on whatever podcast app you use. Give us a rating on iTunes. It helps us get discovered by people who don't follow me on Twitter. We have a website, postscarcitymagazine.com, that has all the episodes. You can search by tag so you can find a specific subject. And it also has the show notes for most of the season 2 episodes have show notes linked to them. I might go back one day and put all my OneNote notes into the Google Docs and then link those to the episodes, but that'll be somewhat lengthy project, so not doing that this might weekend, I don't think.
It might happen in between seasons.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably a good time to do it. We have a Twitter account at NeighborSciPod, Instagram at NeighborScience, Facebook.com/NeighborScience. That one I think neither Peter nor I really go on Facebook, so we just kind of post the episodes there.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Oh, and Patreon.com/NeighborScience. You can support us for any amount of money, and you will get access to any outtakes that we have. So, like, all our pre-show chats and whatever stuff I deem not on track enough to make it into the episode so that we can get it down to a reasonable length.
Also, we have recently had our podcast evaluated for a full market valuation of $5.3 billion for anyone interested in buying the podcast.
So you could get in on the ground floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to do an initial coin offering soon. We're creating our own cryptocurrency.
Neighbor coin.
I think that's it. Right?
Yeah. Just last thing. If we do go with the neighbor coin thing, we are developing what is called the block party chain technology. So, keep an eye out for that.
Block BLOC.
Yeah.
Because everything has to be more communist with us, you know.
Exactly. Okay, cool. Thanks for listening, everyone. And have a great week.
Yep. Bye.